Hi, this is Zoe Durand, and I'm a family lawyer and mediator, and you're listening to the Inside Family Law podcast. This podcast is presented by Mediation Answers in partnership with Artwork and Lawyer Magic. Over the course of these episodes, I will take you on a 360-degree deep dive into all aspects of the family law process by talking with some of the greatest minds in family. I'm hoping that through this podcast, we can really encourage interdisciplinary conversations and perspectives that allow us to go deeper into what is really going on in the family law process, and that also make us more curious in our approaches to family law and how we do what we do every day. Hi, this is the Inside Family Law podcast. I'm reporting live at the Pacifica Congress Conference here in Hobart, Tasmania. I am here with two of the fabulous facilitators. I'll let them introduce themselves and what you each do and where you're from.
Lovely to be here and talking with you. I'm Sally Nichols. I'm the managing partner of a family law firm in Melbourne, and I'm very privileged today to be talking about family violence in the sense that we're actually looking at ways we can disrupt and prevent and educate, and we're doing that through a fabulous film that's been produced and directed by Shana Blaze.
Fantastic. And what do you do, Shana?
I'm Shana Blaze. I am actually known as an interior designer, but I am now a film producer and executive producer, and I'm also co-founder of a charity called Voice of Change that Sally is on the board. And we have created this movie so that we can make change in family and domestic violence before it happens.
Okay, so do you want to just tell me a bit about the movie and what happens in it?
The movie is based in a family house, and the mother creates a beautiful little tent that the son calls a fort, and that becomes this beautiful magical place that the mother and son can transform themselves into other worlds to escape the family and domestic violence in the home. So it also shows their relationship, it also shows the father's relationship, and it shows a lot of levels of coercive control that we're trying to get a handle on at the moment. So it shows coercive control, but it also shows the reality of all the different types of violence with a perpetrator, with the victim, and for the people around them, including the children, family members, and how people react, don't react, and how things end up in the real world.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can ask this, and if I can't, I'll take this out the road, but how does the film end up? I'm really bad. I always skip to the end. Like, is there a conclusion? Is there kind of some message or messages that come out of it?
I won't tell you the ending, but okay. There is definitely a full message.
Okay.
And the thing is, at the end, we show statistics that are very relevant for today, and it really is using the arts to create a trigger to make people think and to really humanise the experience of what's going on screen rather than us hearing every week all the statistics of all the different types of violence, because we become a little bit numb to it, and the arts are used as that tool of that emotional trigger.
And an amazing message for me watching it, I've watched it now a few times, is to break that cycle. I think that's a really clear message, and I've been on a number of panels and listened to audience reactions to watching it, and what's really inspiring is that a lot of people say, what can I do? What can I do to facilitate change? And one of the big messages that's come out is, don't be an active bystander. Just if you
sorry,
actually...
Sorry, no, be an active
bystander. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Can we scrub that one? Be an active bystander is the big message. And just
what
in our
mean?
Daily... Well, in our daily life, if we actually sense that somebody, whether it be a work colleague or a friend or a family member, is actually, or even a relative stranger, just an associate, but if they're giving and displaying the symptoms and some of the behaviours that we actually see in the film, particularly of the mum, for example, or the little boy, I would suggest would be showing symptoms at school, signs, ask can I help? What can I do? Mm. And we talk a lot about that proactivity and being an active bystander after the film's made. And we've heard from a number of people, including some incredible men, to talk about how you can actually be amazing from a male perspective and look out and call it out, calling out behaviours as well.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, if we don't act on an everyday level, we will always have these statistics, because it's behind closed doors. It's full of shame. People don't talk about it. And, you know, I guarantee when we're in this Congress, the statistics are that there'll be people in that room that are victims of coercive control, of violence, and there will be perpetrators. You know, that's just the reality. So we've got to live in this world where we can't be afraid to call out bad behaviour. And I'm not talking about confronting violence. I'm talking about if you're in a boardroom, you're in a meeting, and somebody puts somebody down. We're so used to just not saying anything because we're going to embarrass somebody. Mm. But in the end, that person's getting away with bad behaviour, and once they get away with it, they feel they have the power to get away with it again. So we have the power to actually call out bad behaviour and make change. It really is as simple as that, and then it's a ripple effect that goes on and on.
So just to sort of step back a bit, so some people listening to this will have a lot more knowledge, a lot more experience in family law than others, or they might have different ideas of what, when you say family violence. Can you just very, very briefly, and I know you could probably say a lot more about it, but just when people think of family violence, some people still just think physical only. Like, what does family violence mean? What can it mean?
Look, I think the coercive control is so many things, but the biggest thing that we see, and especially with what, you know, Sally deals with, is financial abuse. And it's abuse of all different ways. So if people don't have access to finances to be able to have some sort of freedom, people that actually have abuse of when they're not allowed to go out, abuse of their freedom, abuse of the roles of gender equality. And it really comes down to people falling into any type of controlling behaviour and being the victim of controlling behaviour. And it could be through words, it could be emotional abuse, financial abuse, your sense of freedom. And you see so much more than I do.
During COVID, we saw the use of COVID in bizarre ways also to as a form of family violence, using COVID in that situation to control people as well, particularly women who for whom English was a second language. Yeah. They'd be told and communicated false information. There'd be threats about, I'm going to give you COVID, or you can't do X, Y and Z, you can't go out. I think that was a really, really quite a shocking outcome in relation to COVID as well.
I mean, I remember a matter that I had, obviously, on a no-names basis, where someone had to fill in, like, timesheets of their day, you know, their entire day, like, what they did all day to show the value to their spouse.
Yes.
Like, that's so mind-bending, you know, to those of us that don't live in that situation.
Oh, and people are tracked.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of... This pattern of behaviour is what... I know the Attorney General's trying to actually have a common definition amongst all the states in Australia and territories, which would also be very helpful, so we can actually really call it out, because there are different... Because we have different state laws, there is different definitions of coercive control, and I think that's a really great idea, to have a national definition of what coercive control is.
And I think the great thing about that is that, you know, working the states coming together means that the general public can then understand, because coercive control is basically a new word we've been using. Mm. And when we started the movie, because we don't work in that space, we didn't even know that there was coercive control. We knew there was manipulation and control of people. But now we know that coercive control is a pattern of behaviour that's very real and very controlling and very abusive. And we should be coming together to work on it together, and I think that's the exciting thing about the states of Australia coming together to define coercive control, because we need that definition, because again, as I said, this is all behind closed doors, and if you've got somebody that has English as a second language and they are controlled, they will never hear the word coercive control. But if it's in the general public, at the school, at the shops where she goes to, she'll hear about it. Then it becomes common knowledge what coercive control is, and it is a definite behaviour pattern of behaviour.
Mm. I mean, I've had clients, and when I've talked to them, they're like, oh, but it wasn't violence because he never hit me, or she never hit me, whatever it is. And then you explain, he's like, yeah, that's exactly what I've been going through. I just thought I was in living hell, you know. I didn't really know what it was kind of, you know, they know what was going on, but they wouldn't have named it that way. And so it's interesting.
It's extraordinary lack of empathy too, something I think is consistent as well. Really not seeing that person as their own, as an individual and a human being. And that's, I think that's really, in terms of assaults as well, really common, that complete lack of empathy.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is a simplicity of saying they're a possession, but then they're also somebody for them to control. It is their right to control that
person.
Entitlement. Exactly. And, you know, you think where we are in 2023, you think of that behaviour that could be like the 1700s or the 1400s or the 1950s, but we're still here. And that level of control is escalating, and we're intelligent beings, and it's not changing.
And it's calling, I think it's calling out language as well. So if you're an employer and you have actually somebody, as Shane said, who comes in and might misbehave in a boardroom or might actually talk about their spouse in a really derogatory way at work, it's calling it out as an employer to say, look, if the bitch has actually just gone me for child support, it's actually saying, look, that language is not tolerated here in this workplace. You need to come into HR.
It takes a bit of courage, doesn't it? We need to find it, maybe.
Well, there's actually education now of employers not to actually allow that type of behaviour because it's considered abusive and just disrespectful in the workplace. But obviously there's a human being behind that that language and behaviour that needs, and it needs to be called out.
And it's really interesting because there's some great associations called Tomorrow Man and Man Cave. Tomorrow Man, Tomorrow Woman, Man Cave. And they talk about the muscle memory of what your reaction is. And I was, you know, privy to a couple of those things through my lifetime, but, you know, just being in the public eye. Because I'm in the public eye, people feel that they can just say whatever they want about me. But people don't know how to react to that. And there was a live interview where somebody was saying something derogatory about me in the public eye, and the people listening laughed because they didn't know what to do. They didn't
know
how to. Exactly. Oh, we can't, in the public eye, we can't say to this person who has power, oh, no, we don't agree with you. So it comes down to that muscle memory that we need some tools, even if it's five words or five sayings, that we can come in and somebody says something wrong, that we have those same sayings, and if that person hears it quite a few times, well, they won't say it again.
I know this is a bit digressing, but when my daughter was in daycare, they used to teach her, stop it, I don't like it.
Yes, yeah.
Like,
yes.
Even I think the younger generation are learning some things a little
differently.
Definitely. Because we were very much just please everyone. That's how I was raised when I was young.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that's created a lot of problems, to be honest.
Yeah.
And that's the key that we're trying to do through Voice of Change. So using the arts to use the message creatively and not as a direct soapbox platform, but to use it so that it ingrains in people's minds so they absorb it more. Because people don't like to be told what to do.
No.
So if you use the arts as messaging, then you can have the facts, you can have the science, then you can have the delivery of what people should do, because they can see the arts, the emotional message, they've made the human connection. Okay, what do I need to do? Here are the tools. So it becomes this package that will be available and can be done, but we need to all collectively do it. It's not just up to the lawyers, the police, the judges. We've got to do it as a community.
And now, just a couple of words about Lawyer Magic, a one-day course on the secret sauce to law practice scale-up. We demystify all the parts around being a lawyer that you actually need to know to thrive in law, but usually no one teaches you. The three pillars to Lawyer Magic are the law of attraction, being magnetic, branding, marketing, and positioning yourself as an expert, the honeymoon phase, drawing clients to you, networking, building referral chains, keeping the spark alive, keeping clients happy along the whole journey and getting paid seamlessly, but in a way that clients understand the value of your work. Nicole Evans said, Zoe and Roey were fantastic. They tailored this course around our firm and our needs. We all took away a lot of practical tips and new ideas to implement on a day-to-day basis. We believe the real magic happens by identifying what is naturally unique about you, including your special passions, and showing how to amplify and communicate this. Exhibit A, hopefully like I'm doing in this podcast.
And I guess where can people sort of access this movie that you've made, this wonderful movie?
So we had a major release, which has been really exciting, but the theatres aren't at a great space at the moment that we can have it collectively. So now that we've had a major release, we're looking at options of distribution with streaming, and that probably won't be for a few months, but if people want to contact Voice of Change, we can actually give them access to screening in their school, in their corporate area. We really encourage educational areas and also corporates to watch this movie and then sit down and have a discussion, because that's what it's about. When you leave this movie, you are so impacted, as Sally said, that you have to talk about it.
And it's wonderful to see. We've had people like the Victims of Crime Commissioner watch the movie but also speak to it and really endorse it as a wonderful tool in relation to all those aims of education, prevention and disruption. It's really important.
I mean, in terms of how do we break the cycle of things, I mean, that's such a huge question. What are some of the things? Is it start with things like this? Like, what are... Because sometimes it is overwhelming.
Get the conversation going.
Yeah.
And it's little things. I think it's really important. And it's even now I'm remembering times where I have actually stood up and said, no, stop it, I don't like it, effectively. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people who are working with family violence victims all the time, or victim survivors, I think you still are attuned in your environment, whether it be corporate or a law firm, to actually allowing those regressive behaviours or comments in the past go to the keeper, so to speak, and we can't. We just can't do it.
And the thing is that we've been doing lots of screenings with corporations and with government and police. Mm. And the thing is that we know that we have to get into the corporations that have their culture. So we're talking to places of people and culture in corporations. So we highly recommend people to have the movie and have that discussion and set the rules and the grounding of what is the culture in the business. Because as much as we have people and culture, the culture isn't set. They say, oh, we've got our policies, but how is it ingrained throughout?
But things are always fluid, things are always changing.
Well, I think exactly.
I was really taught, I remember the former CEO of Wire used to talk to us about calling out people at work for talking about their spouse in a really derogatory way. And we also did a bit of work with Rugby Victoria, and actually World Rugby, about making vilification of a woman a code violation. And that's that. And Rugby, World Rugby agreed to do that and have a pilot project in Victoria. And so we could do some education around family violence within rugby teams from a grassroots level as well. And calling it out is also really, really important. So you're looking at spheres of influence, as Shana said, outside the judicial system, which, as you said, we're at the end of the track in some ways. Why don't we actually try and call it out and go into grassroots through sporting arenas, through corporate, through education?
I think a really, really prominent case right at the moment is the female soccer, the player who was kissed on the lips and grabbed, and he actually pushed himself into her, and she said she didn't give consent, and all of a sudden you had the Spanish Association saying that it was her fault. And there's video evidence, there's everything there, and they're also showing that she was showed the video in the bus and someone filmed her laughing at it. That's that muscle memory of embarrassment, shame. She doesn't know how to react, and she was trying to laugh it off.
That's fine, but really inside exactly. She might have felt it was fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Victims don't come to the board straight away. They don't say, this is what happened to me, unless you've got that full support. So straight away, we've got something where we've got video evidence, we have the public eye, and we have the media, and then all of a sudden,
people
are blaming
victim shame.
Victim shaming.
Yeah.
And so if somebody in that public... Yes, they've got all the support of the whole team. They've got video evidence, but they're still victim shaming. Imagine somebody who has no evidence. Mm. That's what we're looking up against.
Who's not in a power position. Exactly. You know, as you said, all kinds of reasons why they're not, they're kind of pushed down. Mm.
So that can be used as a really simple example of why the victim doesn't come forward, how misidentification can happen, and also the fact that the victim is all of a sudden the perpetrator.
And they're worried about getting that second layer. Like, they've already gone through something, then they're going to get
exactly.
a second layer. Well, that's your fault and this, that and the other. And you never know how people are going to receive information when you tell them. It's really interesting what you're both talking about is because when you think of like family violence or, you know, people say domestic violence or whatever, that's like in the private sphere.
Yes.
But all these things you're doing, it's kind of like you're talking about organisations, workplaces, because it does all connect up. And I have to say for me, I'll be honest, I may be a bit naive to it. Well, that's quite illuminating because I'd never thought about it in terms of that flow on, like if someone says something at work, you know, call it out because then that might change their perceptions about, well, it could be a little sort of...
It's socially
unacceptable. Yeah, absolutely. Kind
of, you know, of what, this is what you're actually saying. They don't accept that.
And there are great organisations. What made me think about that sphere of influence is I was talking to women in McDonald's in terms of leadership. There was a number of speakers, and I actually said, do you think of 100,000 young people being employed by McDonald's? And we were talking at the time about cyber safety, and they've got all those digital TVs. You've got so many people. It's the biggest, I think, provider of free Wi-Fi, public Wi-Fi in Australia after schools and public libraries. So if you actually have issues, appropriate education tools screened on their digital TVs, or actually in their training of their staff is excellent. So we did some cyber safety modules with them, with the Ilana and Madeline Foundation, and just that little tweak means that you've got 100,000 employees who have compulsory training on cyber safety and anti-bullying to try and actually get that shift.
Just a shift, just a different way of looking at it.
I mean, exactly.
And people learn things in stages. It might not be the first. It might be the first time they hear it, they go, oh, that's interesting. Second time they hear it, they might go a bit deeper. Third, you know, they can learn. It's just hearing things a few times and reflecting a few times.
And if they've been shown on the sporting field, saying you play like a girl, it's not to be tolerated. So when we actually announced that code violation in Dublin in 2017, we had World Rugby announce that they endorsed it. I had to go onto Irish radio and I knew nothing about rugby. but I was terrified. But actually they were really, the headlines were, and there was one that got 2 million hits, you can no longer say you're playing like a girl. And it really took off because it is a cultural response. But it can't be tolerated. I mean, maybe playing like a girl, if we look at the Matildas, is a pretty awesome thing to do.
Let's turn it around. Exactly. It's about flipping the narrative.
Exactly.
And the power of that. Yeah. And I think, you know, we're talking about where we are in family and domestic violence. We are at that really dire pointy end. It has never been worse. And
where are we at statistically with everything?
I have to say I'm horrified because the last month the statistics would show maybe 3 or 4 women a week that are murdered.
It was one a week.
We had in January and February.
Well,
that's just within those couple of months. But if you do the average over the year, we haven't got to the year. But we started in January and February. You think of those first 4 weeks of January, we had about 4 murders a week. And then the last month, we've had about 3 or 4 murders a week.
Shocking.
But then the other ones is like, you know, oh, we've only had 2 this month or whatever. We shouldn't have any. That's the thing. And the trouble is it's so layered. And I was just reading a case the other day he's just been sentenced, and I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but it was just sentenced the other day. But they broke up 3 years ago, and he still couldn't handle the fact that he couldn't have her. They were childhood sweethearts. They were together for 20 years. He abused her through the whole marriage. She broke up with him, and she felt safe because it had been 3 years. And as he was killing her, the landlord heard, "I told you I would kill you." The thing is that we are looking at the scope of family violence of not just in the court, we're not just talking about what happens to keep people safe at the moment, we're talking about how do we react before it even gets to that stage, how do we educate our children not to be able to do that, how do we work within the courts, how do we deal with long-term trauma, but how do we keep them safe years later? So that's why it's so layered, and that's why our language, our muscle memory of who we are as a community in the workforce, in the sporting arena, and in the workplace of what we do, that we have to have similar messages. Because as you said, if you hear it once, twice, 3 times, then it's ingrained.
And I'm talking to some of the county court judges not so long ago about what the different qualities of some of these offenders, particularly sexual assault offenders, is that they just do not see their victim as another human being. It is that incredible lack of empathy.
And so possession, object.
Yeah, I interviewed a documentary maker for the World Congress on Family Law and Children's Rights in 2017 in Dublin, and she'd made a documentary called India's Daughter, interviewing all the rapists the prosecutors, and that was particularly disturbing, the prosecutors of the rape and murder of this young girl who was on a bus with a friend, a male friend, going to see a movie, and these men were outraged that she was out without a chaperone. And they violated her just hideously, and she died an awful, awful death, and it caused riots in India. But the underlying message was that they did not see her as a human being. And even one of the prosecutors said, oh, if someone finds a diamond on the road, it was this grotesque image, and it's unprotected, of course they're going to pick it up. And that was the prosecutor. And so what the documentary maker did was partner with some education specialists to talk about setting up a curriculum called Think Equal that teaches children about empathy. Mm-hmm. Again, very similar to what Voice of Change is trying to do, but from an education point of view, trying to make sure that you actually go in and get to children from an ELC level, 3 and 4 year olds. And some of the training is just incredible. It's taking a white sheet of paper, holding it up to your skin and saying, look, no one's white. We're all shades of brown. So it's very simplistic, gorgeous things, but it's also teaching about the impact you have on others, but from a very simple, that we're actually all equal.
And now a few words about artwork, where we bring art to your place of work. As some of you might know, away from the law, I have pursued a passion for art, exhibiting in London, Sydney, Melbourne, throughout China, and at a contemporary show in the Louvre in Paris. I'm now sharing my love of art and creativity with workplaces. I'd love to hear from you if you would be interested in team bonding art lessons, curated pieces for your office, or making your next corporate event a showstopper with a piece of art created live for your guests. I'm also interested in any of the other ideas you might have about how to inject creativity into your place of work and shake things up, hopefully in a good way. The benefit of working with me is that uniquely I am both an artist and a lawyer, so I have an understanding of the law firm corporate events context and can chew the fat with your guests about law, life, art, and my creative process whilst I create your special piece for your firm. Bronwyn O'Lone said, "This was truly an amazing experience. We keep getting comments from those that joined us on our special evening about how inspiring it was to watch you create such beautiful art. The memories will live on in the artwork, which will be hung proudly in our meeting space."
Well, I was going to say, what you're saying, I mean, this is a bit left of field, but I was actually discussing this just socially with someone else at the conference. I was saying, I can say this on my podcast, but I think I can, that there's a problem with how people... the knowledge that we have when we leave school with how to pick a partner. Like, what do we have? You've got Disney, you've got fairy tales, you've got porn. And then we're meant to go into the world and then pick a partner. And that was at least when I was at school. There's sex education, but there wasn't, like, love education. Like, I really think it would be great if there was. Maybe there is now, because I haven't been in school for a long time. Education on what is, like, a healthy relationship. What, you know, like, that's...
It's true they're trying to put things in, particularly around consent. At the moment.
There is a lot of consent.
There are some great programs, but it's not mandatory. Mm. There is Respectful Relationships, which is mandatory in Victoria, but not in all the other states. Mm. But the thing is, we have Respectful Relationships, and it starts from primary school. Then we also have consent. You know, we have some incredible laws happening around consent and a lot of noise about consent. Mm. But right alongside it is the biggest problem is strangulation in porn, where... young kids are watching porn, and the statistics are that a boy will watch it from 12, mm-hmm. and a girl will watch it from 14. So in their minds, strangulation is the biggest thing, and they normalise strangulation. And the trouble is that you have 13 and 14-year-olds having their first sexual experience that think violence is normal, because that's what they hear, because no one wants to talk about porn and no one wants to talk about sexual relationships.
And that's why I'm keeping this on the podcast. I'm not editing this bit out.
And you have to. You have to, because and it's also, as parents, you have to know that this is happening to kids, because they have access to all devices, and it doesn't matter what you put on as blocks on their devices, it gets around. So kids think that strangulation is normal, and we're talking with a lot of experts in strangulation, and what happens is that they might only do it for 5 or 6 seconds in a strangulation in porn, in sexual relationships, but it weakens the nerves and it weakens the what is happening in the neck, that the next time, the third time, they might only do it for 2 seconds and they've murdered somebody. That is the reality. And so the normalisation of strangulation is right next to consent. But because they're being told that this is normal, they have to consent because of the peer pressure. So there is all this talk of consent, but then there's the peer group pressure of what they should be consenting to. Because, oh, that's normal, you're
crude. Do you want to be boring or do you want to be fun?
All of that. So all that peer group pressure comes in and takes away the consent. So that's why it's important to know it from very young
age. And there's an excellent documentary on porn. And I know that one of my dear friends is a really strong advocate of it as an educational tool in schools, but it's very controversial. But it does actually involve ex-porn actors who are actually wearing nappies and saying, this ain't fun, and what you're actually seeing is just, it's really contrived, and actually it lifts the veil, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it actually looks at strangulation per se, but it definitely looks at violence.
Yeah.
But very, very important topic, and I've embarrassed my son so much in talking about it, and they go, oh, mum, I said, well, you know, it's not normal. I know you're going to look at that.
Yeah.
It really isn't, and it's really harmful, and it betrays violence. But I think not many people want to have those conversations.
Yeah.
It's important.
Especially parents with their children and that.
Yeah, and I've actually said it to a few friends of mine who have, you know, teenagers, and I said to them, you've got to talk about this. And they said, oh, how do we do it? And I said, straight out, have you been watching porn? Are your friends? Like, what's the norm? And then they'll just go, oh, Mum, no, no. And you go, well, I'm really sorry. I just heard somebody died from strangulation. Do you see strangulation? You've got it. What they're seeing is so aggressive that you can't sit there and be a bystander. You have to be an active bystander, and that's the difference.
Yeah. My girlfriend, at her 50th, this particular girlfriend, she had such a passion for it that she's three sons, and a 16-year-old said, it's just really amazing having my mum, because my friends would come over at 16 and she'll say, now, have you watched porn? and they go, and she said, well,
great.
You all came out of a vagina.
Yes.
So, you know, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And they'd be, oh. But it's but it was actually wonderful to hear him say, actually, what a gift his mum was. And even though she became quite notorious for these conversations amongst his friends. But I think there was a respect there, and they knew why it was important. They were converts. They understood it. It was really important.
So in terms of where we're at with law, like family law and family violence, like what are the changes you want to see in either the legislation or how we deal with family violence?
I think there's a couple of practical realities. Yeah. I know a lot of the women's legal services would really like to see coercive control and stipulated and set out as a pattern of behaviour on intervention orders. So when a practical thing is if a perpetrator is issued with an intervention order, for example, and people would know to restrain, it's an order normally made in a magistrate's court to restrain anyone from assaulting, intimidating, harassing, or coming within a certain distance of a victim survivor, that there's an explanation on the back in terms of certain conduct that constitutes a breach, and I think setting coercive control out in full, and including certain behaviours that we've just described today, would be good, and having that national definition of coercive control would be
good
really
changes.
And we need the states, because there's no referral powers about this. It's been recommended by the National Attorney General, and we need the states at the moment. Victoria's, and I know it hasn't done it yet. I think ACT might be, but there, we really need to get this common definition going.
I'd like to, you know, as somebody who's not, as I said, I don't work in the area of law, I would like to see if people breach it that there are more consequences, because we were talking about financial abuse before. So, you know, you've got the Commonwealth Bank and you've got NAB Bank and Westpac that have been doing control laws looking at when people are putting in their child maintenance. And so instead of just putting in the child maintenance, they'll actually write in there, die you bitch. Here's your fucking money, because you can write whatever you want. So they have these things where they can screen it. So they're breaches of coercive control, but it really should be, what are the consequences for them doing it?
Consequences for actions.
That's the thing. Like, we don't have to put people in jail, but The biggest thing is patterns of behaviour need to be treated, and they need to actually have laws that people have to go to classes to learn how to break the anger, the violence, and for them to really understand that they've got coercive control. So as much as we're focusing on the victim, we have to look at how we can help the perpetrator change their patterns so they can actually be part of society.
Because Shona mentioned it before, and she's absolutely right. The pattern is people might start with a small thing that might be just vilifying or making a statement. And people say, oh, they're just words. But then if people get away with it, they become more empowered.
Do you know what I mean?
And it does lead to serious assaults. It really does start with just as we said, something quite that seems minor, but then it actually it increases too the more they get away with it.
Yeah, I definitely, with law, I would like to see consequences and patterns of behaviour that need to be corrected, and there needs to be more classes, and there needs to be more mandatory classes to go to about all different types of violence.
Well, we have, for example, there is obligations on an employer to have OCC health and safety talks once a year in relation to sexual harassment and bullying. This should be included, you know, in terms of the way in which you...
Yeah,
exactly.
It's just really interesting what you're saying, and when you were saying before, it's like 2023, and here we are, like, at this conference, and we've got AI, and we've got this, but what's that quote? It's, we live in a strange age with Stone Age emotions, medieval beliefs, God love technology, many people from reach. And that is really where we're at, I feel, in 2023. We've got AI, we've got this, we've got all these sophistications technologically, we've still got some Stone Age emotions, we've still got some medieval beliefs, like victim-shaming things.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
And this inability to regulate emotions, but particularly, as we know, the financial times are difficult for people. Mm. So we're seeing, as Shana mentioned, increase in financial abuse at the moment, but also to just a lot of pressure. We're seeing the fallout from people being under economic stress at the moment, and they're not able to find their way out in an appropriate way and to regulate their emotions.
Mm-hmm. So that there, I think there isn't a simple answer, but at the same time, if we all think that there's all these things happening, it's what do we do, what can't we do? We have to go back to basics. It's the simple things. It has to be humanity, it has to be calling people out in a safe way and looking at patterns of behaviour and being able to break them. And we need to educate ourselves as human beings on how to be a bystander. And Voice of Change, we have links to places that you can go. We have it based in schools, we have it based in workplace, sport. So people really have the power to educate themselves. There's places out there, there's tools. And, you know, our long-term goal with Voice of Change is to collaborate with these companies and be able to do tool packs and, you know, whatever arts project we do. So Voice of Change, the Ford is our first project. We've learnt so much. So our next project will have more educational tools alongside it. And that is the goal, that using the arts to trigger, to get people into the emotions, to understand, to stand up and go, I can't sit here and do nothing. What do I do? Mm. Here's your pack. Take it here. Open the conversation.
Well, like you said, if you're a parent, you've got your teenage kids, you can say something to them. If you're in the workplace, someone says something, you know, you can say, you know, there are things we can do on a small level.
We need the words.
Yeah, because words are powerful. Mm. They can actually disrupt. They can, you know, make change. Words are about emotions, but also they can be quite harmful. We want to stop
they
that.
Can. I mean, it's a form of propaganda, I think.
Yeah.
Well, look, thank you both very much for discussing it with me today. Where can people reach you if they want to talk further? This has been such a really good conversation. I'll put links below anyway, but just so they could contact you at your firm, is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes, and contact me at voiceofchange.org.au, or you could actually contact QSB Productions or go on my website, shannablaze.com, and there's some contacts there just to keep the conversation going, direct you to everything. And it's really important that we keep the conversation going.
All right. Thank you both so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so, so much for listening to this episode of Inside Family Law. I hope you got a lot out of it and that it has sparked a lot of questions and conversations that you'll keep having with your colleagues in the area. If you do want to stay connected with me, then please reach out on LinkedIn. You can find me, I'm Zoe Duran, or you can reach me on Instagram at Mediation Answers. My website is www.mediationanswers.com.au. If you have any fabulous ideas for a podcast interview,
please be in touch with me. Also, if you would like me to cover your family law conference, for example, or any other conference or event, I'm more than happy to discuss if this would work. So please also do reach out. Thanks very much, and I hope you listen in next time.